and home. Total bullion shipped from Mexico and Peru between 1500 and 1650 exceeded 180 tons. Yet Spain did not view the New World as land to be developed, and rather than using the wealth as a base from which to create a thriving commercial sector, Spain allowed its gold to sit in royal vaults, unemployed in the formation of new capital. Spanish attitudes weighed heavily upon the settlers of New Spain, who quickly were outpaced by the more commercially oriented English outposts. Put another way, Spain remained wedded to the simplest form of mercantilism, whereas the English and Dutch advanced in the direction of a freer and more lucrative system in which business was less subordinated to the needs of the state. Since governments lacked the information possessed by the collective buyers and sellers in the marketplace, governments inevitably were at a disadvantage in measuring supply and demand. England thus began to shoot ahead of Spain and Portugal, whose entrepreneurs found themselves increasingly enmeshed in the snares of bureaucratic mercantilism. France in the New World. France, the last of the major colonizing powers, abandoned mercantilism more quickly than the Spanish, but not as rapidly as the English. Although not eager to colonize North America, France feared leaving the New World to its European rivals. Following early expeditions along the coast of Newfoundland, the first serious voyages by a French captain into North America were conducted under Jacques Cartier in 1534. Searching for the fabled Northwest Passage, a northerly water route to the Pacific, he sailed up the St. Lawrence, reaching the present site of Montreal. It was another 70 years, however, before the French established a permanent settlement there. Samuel de Champlain, a pious cartographer considered one of the greatest inland explorers of all time, searched for a series of lakes that would link the Atlantic and Pacific, and in 1601 established a fort on a rocky point called Quebec, from the Algonquin word Quebec, or where the river narrows. Roughly 20 years later, France chartered the Company of New France, a trading firm designed to populate French holdings in North America. Compared to English colonial efforts, however, New France was a disappointment, in no small part because one of the most enthusiastic French groups settled in the southeastern part of the United States, not Canada, placing them in direct contact with the powerful Spanish. The French government, starting a trend that continued to the time of the Puritans, answered requests by religious dissidents to plant a colony in the southernmost reaches of North America. Many dissenters born of the Protestant Reformation sought religious freedom from Catholic governments. These included French Protestants known as Huguenots. Violent anti-Protestant prejudices in France served as a powerful inducement for the Huguenots to emigrate. Huguenots managed to land a handful of volunteers in Port Royal Sound, present-day South Carolina, in 1562, but the colony failed. 2 years later, another expedition successfully settled at Fort Caroline in Florida, which came under attack from the Spanish, who slaughtered the unprepared inhabitants, ending French challenges to Spanish power in the southern parts of North America. From that point on, France concentrated its efforts on the northern reaches of North America, Canada, where Catholicism, not Protestantism, played a significant role in French-Canadian expansion alongside the economics of the fur trade. French colonization trailed that of the English for several reasons. Quebec was much colder than most of the English colonial sites, making it a much less attractive destination for emigrants. Also, the French peasants in the 1600s were more tightly controlled by the monarchy and were less free to emigrate to America than their English counterparts. Finally, the French government, concerned with maintaining a large base of domestic military recruits, did not encourage migration to New France. As a result, by 1700, English colonists in North America outnumbered French settlers 6-1. Despite controlling the St. Lawrence and Mississippi rivers, New France, deprived by its inland character of many of the advantages available to the coastal English settlements, saw only a meager trickle to the region. As few as 27,000 French came to Canada in 150 years, and two-thirds of those departed without leaving descendants there. Even so, New France had sustained economic appeal. Explorers had not found gold or silver, but northern expeditions discovered riches of another sort. Furs. Vast Canadian forests offered an abundance of highly valued deer, elk, rabbit, and beaver skins and pelts, harvested by an indigenous population eager to trade. Trapping required deep penetration into forests controlled by Indians, and the French found that they could obtain furs far more easily through barter than they could by deploying their own army of trappers with soldiers to protect them. Thus, French traders ventured deep into the interior of Canada to exchange knives, blankets, cups, and, when necessary, guns with the Indians for pelts. It should be noted that these articles were far from trinkets, as historians often describe. They were the products of industrialization, few of which existed in Indian societies. Thus, they were indeed desirable products. At the end of a trading journey, the coureurs du bois, runners of the woods, returned to Montreal, where they sold the furs to merchants who shipped them back to Europe. That strategy demanded that France limit the number of its colonists and discourage settlement, particularly in Indian territories. France attempted to deal with natives as friends and trading partners, but quickly realized that the Indians harbored as much enmity for each other as they did for the Europeans. If not careful, France could find itself on the wrong end of an alliance. So, where possible, the French government restrained colonial intrusions into Indian land, with the exception of missionaries such as Jacques Marquette, 1673, and René de La Salle, 1681. The English presence. Despite the voyages of John Cabot, English explorers trailed in the wake of the Portuguese, Spanish, and French. England, at the beginning of the 16th century, was backward in commerce, industry, and wealth, and therefore did not rank as one of the great European nations. When Queen Elizabeth took the throne in 1558, the situation changed. The nation developed a large navy with competent, often skilled, sailors. Moreover, profits from piracy and privateering provided strong incentives to bold seamen, especially sea dogs like John Hawkins and Francis Drake, to join in plundering the Spanish sea lanes. By that time, the English reading public had become fascinated with the writings of Humphrey Gilbert, especially A Discourse to Prove a Passage by Northwest to Cathaya and the East Indies, 1576, which closed with a challenge to Englishmen to discover that water route. In 1578, Elizabeth granted him rights to plant an English colony in America, but he died in an attempt to colonize Newfoundland. Walter Raleigh, Gilbert's half-brother, inherited the grant and sent vessels to explore the coast of North America before determining where to locate a settlement. That expedition reached North Carolina in the summer of 1584. After spending 2 months traversing the land, commenting on its vegetation and natural beauty, the explorers returned to England with glowing reports. Raleigh supported a second expedition in 1585, at which time 100 settlers landed at Roanoke on the Carolina coast. When the transports had sailed for England, leaving the colony alone, it nearly starved, and only the fortunate arrival of Drake, fresh from new raiding, provided it with supplies. Raleigh, undeterred by the near disaster, planned another settlement for Roanoke, by which time Richard Hakluyt's Discourse on Western Planting, 1584, further ginned up enthusiasm for settling in the region. Settlers received stock in Raleigh's company, which attracted 133 men and 17 women who set sail on 3 ships. They reached Roanoke Island in 1587, and a child born on that island, Virginia Dare, technically became the first European born in America. As with the previous English expedition, the ships, under the command of the governor, John White, returned to England for more supplies, only to arrive under the impending threat of a Spanish invasion of England, a failed invasion that would result in the spectacular defeat of the Spanish Armada in 1588, leaving England as the predominant sea power in the world. Delays prohibited the supply ships from returning to Roanoke until 1591, when John White found the Roanoke houses standing, but no settlers. A mysterious clue, the word Croatoan, carved on a tree, remains the only evidence of their fate. Croatoan Indians lived somewhat nearby, but they were considered friendly, and neither White nor generations of historians have solved the puzzle of the lost colony of Roanoke. Whatever the fate of the Roanoke settlers, the result for England was that by 1600, there still were no permanent English colonies in America. Foundations for English success in the New World, a hypothesis. England had laid the foundation for successful North American settlements well before the first permanent colony was planted at Jamestown in 1607. Although it seemed insignificant in comparison to the large empire already established by the Spanish, Virginia and subsequent English colonies in Massachusetts would eclipse the settlement of the Iberian nations and France. Why? It is conceivable that English colonies prospered simply by luck, but the dominance of Europe in general and England in particular, a tiny island with few natural resources, suggests that specific factors can be identified as the reasons for the rise of an English Atlantic civilization. The appearance of new business practices, a culture of technological inquisitiveness, and a climate receptive to political and economic risk-taking. One of the most obvious areas in which England surpassed other nations was in its business practices. English merchants had eclipsed their Spanish and French rivals in preparing for successful colonization through adoption of the joint stock company as a form of business. One of the earliest of these joint stock companies, the Company of the Staple, was founded in 1356 to secure control over the English wool trade from Italian competitors. By the 1500s, the Muscovy Company, 1555, the Levant Company, 1592, and the East India Company, 1600, fused the exploration of distant regions with the pursuit of profit. Joint stock companies had two important advantages over other businesses. One advantage was that the company did not dissolve with the death of the primary owner, and thus was permanent. Second, it featured limited liability in which a stockholder could lose only what he invested, in contrast to previous business forms that held owners liable for all of a company's debts. Those two features made investing in an exciting venture in the New World attractive, especially when coupled with the exaggerated claims of the returning explorers. Equally important, however, the joint stock feature allowed a rising group of middle-class merchants to support overseas ventures on an ever-expanding basis. In an even more significant development, a climate receptive to risk-taking and innovation, which had flourished throughout the West, reached its most advanced state in England. It is crucial to realize that key inventions or technologies appeared in non-Western countries first, yet they were seldom, if ever, employed in such a way as to change society dramatically until the Western societies applied them. The stirrup, for example, was known as early as AD 400 to 500 in the Middle East, but it took until 730, when Charles Martel's mounted knights adopted cavalry charges, that combat changed on a permanent basis. Indeed, something other than invention was at work. As sociologist Jack Goldstone put it, the West did not overtake the East merely by becoming more efficient at making bridles and stirrups, but by developing steam engines and by taking unknown risks on novelty. Contrary to the notion that there was little progress in the Dark Ages, Christian Europe pioneered the free farm. Its monasteries fostered literacy, no matter how limited, and saved in writing the works of Greece and Rome as well as Islam. And innovations such as the three-field crop system, the padded horse collar, advanced plows, water wheels, oats, and numerous other developments consistently expanded productivity in agriculture. Music witnessed the appearance of numerous new instruments and polyphonic harmony. Indeed, only Christianity held that there was a rational God capable of being known through reason as well as faith. And it was with this underpinning that most of the early scientists in Europe, including Galileo, Descartes, and Kepler, believed in a creator God. Rodney Stark reported that of 52 stars of the scientific revolution, 32 were devout Christians, 18 were conventionally religious, and only 2 were irreligious. When undertaken with the framework of stable states and the rule of Western law, stability of the state, the rule of law, and a willingness to accept new or foreign ideas rather than ruthlessly suppress them proved vital to entrepreneurship, invention, and technical creativity. While all new ideas were not yet welcome, they found far more receptivity in the West than elsewhere, and in societies dominated by the state, scientists risked their lives if they arrived at unacceptable answers. Still another factor, little appreciated at the time, worked in favor of English ascendancy. Labor scarcity ensured a greater respect for new immigrants, whatever their origins, than had existed in Europe. With the demand for labor came property rights, and with such property rights came political rights unheard of in Europe. Indeed, the English respect for property rights soon eclipsed other factors accounting for England's New World dominance. Born out of the fierce struggles by English landowners to protect their estates from seizure by the state, by the 1600s, property rights had become so firmly established as a basis for English economic activities that its rules permeated even the lowest classes in society. English colonists found land so abundant that anyone could own it, and more astonishingly, they were encouraged to do so by the government. When combined with freedom from royal retribution in science and technological fields, the right to retain the fruit of one's labor, even intellectual property, gave England a substantial advantage in the colonization process over rivals that had more than a century's head start. Taken together, this large body of research on technological progress severely challenges modern notions of multiculturalism, in which all societies grow equally but differently. Indeed, it suggests that without a foundation of certain ideas generally attributed to the West, societies will find technological advance difficult, if not impossible. These advantages would be further enhanced by a growing religious toleration brought about by religious dissenters from the Church of England called Puritans. The Colonial South. In 1606, James I granted a charter to the Virginia Company for land in the New World, authorizing 2 subsidiary companies, the London Company, based in Bristol, and the Plymouth Company, founded by Plymouth stockholders. A group of certain knights, gentlemen, merchants, and other adventurers made up the London Company, which was a joint stock company in the same vein as the Company of the Staple and the Levant Company. The grant to the London Company, reaching from modern-day North Carolina to New York, received the name Virginia in honor of Queen Elizabeth, the Virgin Queen, whereas the Plymouth Company's grant encompassed New England. More than 600 individuals and 50 commercial firms invested in the Virginia Company, illustrating the fundraising advantages available to a corporation. The London Company organized its expedition first, sending 3 ships out in 1607 with 144 boys and men to establish a trading colony designed to extract wealth for shipment back to England. Seeking to propagate the Christian religion in the Chesapeake and to produce a profit for the investors, the London Company owned the land and appointed the governor. Colonists were considered employees. However, as with Raleigh's employees, the colonists enjoyed, as the king proclaimed, all liberties, franchises, and immunities as if they had been abiding and born within this our realm of England. Most colonists lacked any concept of what awaited them. The company adopted a military model based on the Irish campaigns, and the migrants included few farmers or men skilled in construction trades. After a four-month voyage in April 1607, 26-year-old Captain John Smith piloted ships 50 miles up the James River, well removed from eyesight of passing Spanish vessels. It was a site remarkable for its defensive position, but it sat on a malarial swamp surrounded by thick forests that would prove difficult to clear. Tiny triangle-shaped James Fort, as Jamestown was called, featured firing parapets at each corner and contained fewer than two dozen buildings. Whereas defending the fort might have appeared possible, stocking the fort with provisions proved more difficult. Not many of the colonists wanted to work, and none found gold. Some discovered pitch, tar, lumber, and iron for export, but many of the emigrants were gentlemen adventurers who disdained physical labor, as had their Spanish counterparts to the southwest. Smith implored the London Company to send 30 carpenters, husbandmen, gardeners, fishermen, blacksmiths, masons, and diggers up of trees instead of 1,000 of such as we have. Local Indians, such as the Monacan and Chickahominy, traded with the colonists, but the English could neither hire Indian laborers, nor did Indian males express any interest in agriculture themselves. Reaping what they had not sown, the settlers of James Fort starved, with fewer than one-third of the 120 colonists surviving a year. So few remained that the living, Smith noted, were scarcely able to bury the dead. Disease also decimated the colony. Jamestown settlers were leveled by New World diseases for which they had no resistance. Malaria, in particular, proved a dreaded killer, and malnutrition lowered the immunity of the colonists. The brackish water at that point of the James River also fostered mosquitoes and parasites. Virginia was hardly a disease-free paradise before the arrival of the Jamestown English. New microbes transported by the Europeans generated a much higher level of infection than previously experienced by the Indians. Then, in a vicious circle, warring Indian tribes spread the diseases among one another when they attacked enemy tribes and carried off infected prisoners. Thanks to the efforts of Smith, who, as a council president, simply assumed control in 1608, the colony was saved. Smith imposed military discipline and order and issued the famous biblical edict, "He who will not work will not eat." He abandoned the socialist communal model and instituted individual responsibility, thereby stabilizing the colony. And in the second winter, less than 15% of the population died, compared to the more than 60% who died just a year earlier. Smith also organized raids on Indian villages. These brought immediate returns of food and animals, but fostered long-term retribution from the natives, who harassed the colonists when they ventured outside their walls. But Smith was not anti-Indian per se, and even proposed a plan of placing white males in Indian villages to intermarry, hardly the suggestion of a racist. Subsequent settlers developed schools to educate Indians, including William and Mary. Smith ran the colony like an army unit until 1609, when, confident of its survival, the colonists tired of his tyrannical methods and deposed him. At that point, he returned to England, whereupon the London Company, by then calling itself the Virginia Company, obtained a new charter from the king, and it sought to raise capital in England by selling stock and by offering additional stock to anyone willing to migrate to Virginia. The company provided free passage to Jamestown for indentures, or servants willing to work for the Virginia Company for 7 years. A new fleet of 9 ships containing 600 men and some women left England in 1609. One of the ships sank in a hurricane, and another ran aground in Bermuda, where it remained until May 1610. The other vessels arrived at Jamestown only to experience the starving time in the winter of 1609 to 10. English colonists barricaded within James Fort ate dogs, cats, rats, toadstools, and horse hides, ultimately eating from the corpses of the dead. When the remnants of the fleet that had been stuck in Bermuda finally reached Virginia in the late spring of 1610, all the colonists boarded for a return to England. At the mouth of the James River, however, the ships encountered an English vessel bringing supplies. This constituted an astounding miracle for America's survival, given that had the Jamestown group left a mere 30 minutes earlier, they would never have even seen the other English ship. Nevertheless, reprovisioned, the settlers returned to James Fort, and shortly thereafter a new influx of settlers revived the colony. Like Smith, subsequent governors, including the first official governor, Lord Delaware, attempted to operate the colony on a socialist model. Settlers worked in forced labor gangs, shirkers were flogged, and some even hanged. Still, negative incentives only went so far, because ultimately the communal storehouse would sustain anyone in danger of starving, regardless of individual work effort. Administrators realized that personal incentives would succeed where force would not, and they permitted private ownership of land. The application of private enterprise, combined with the introduction of tobacco farming, helped Jamestown survive and prosper, an experience later replicated in Georgia. During the early critical years, Indians were too divided to coordinate their attacks against the English. The powerful chief Powhatan, who led a confederation of more than 20 tribes, enlisted the support of the Jamestown settlers, who he assumed were there for the express purpose of stealing Indian land, to defeat other enemy Indian tribes. Both sides played balance of power politics. Thomas Dale, the deputy governor, proved resourceful in keeping the Indians off balance. At one point, Captain Samuel Argall kidnapped Powhatan's daughter Pocahontas, Matoaka, and held her captive at Jamestown. There she met and eventually married planter John Rolfe in 1614. Their marriage made permanent the uneasy truce that existed between Powhatan and Jamestown. Rolfe and Pocahontas returned to England, where the Indian princess, as a convert to Christianity, proved a popular dinner guest. She epitomized the view that Indians could be evangelized and Europeanized. Tobacco, slaves, and representative government. Rolfe already had made another significant contribution to the success of the colony by curing tobacco in 1612. Characterized by King James I as a vile and stinking custom, smoking tobacco had been promoted in England by Raleigh and had experienced widespread popularity. Columbus had reported Cuban natives rolling tobacco leaves, lighting them on fire, and sticking them in a nostril. By Rolfe's time, the English had refined the custom by using a pipe or by smoking the tobacco directly with the mouth. England already imported more than 200,000 pounds worth of tobacco per year from Spanish colonies, which had a monopoly on nicotine until Rolfe's discovery. Tobacco was not the only substance to emerge from Virginia that would later be considered a vice. George Thorpe perfected a mash of Indian corn that provided a foundation for hard liquor, but tobacco had the greatest potential for profitable production. Substantial change in the production of tobacco only occurred, however, after the Virginia Company allowed individual settlers to own land. In 1617, any free man who migrated to Virginia could obtain a grant of 100 acres of land. Grants were increased for most colonists through the headright policy, under which every head of a household could receive 50 acres for himself and an additional 50 acres for every adult family member or servant who came to America with him. The combination of available land and the growing popularity of tobacco in England resulted in a string of plantations stretching to Failing Creek, well up the James River, and as far west as Dale's Gift on Cape Charles. Virtually all of the plantations had river fronts, allowing ships' captains to dock directly at the plantation, and their influence extended as far as the lands of the Piedmont Indians who traded with the planters. Tobacco cultivation encouraged expansion. The crop demanded large areas of farmland, and the methods of cultivation depleted the soil quickly. Growers steadily moved to interior areas of Virginia, opening still more settlements and requiring additional forts. But the recurring problem in Virginia was obtaining labor, which headright could not provide. Quite the contrary, it encouraged new free farms. Instead, the colony placed new emphasis on indentures, including 20 and odd Negroes brought to Virginia by a Dutch ship in 1619. The status of the first blacks in the New World remains somewhat mysterious, and any thesis about the change in black status generates sharp controversy. Historian Edmund Morgan, in American Slavery, American Freedom, contended that the first blacks had the same legal status as white indentured servants. Other recent research confirms that the lines blurred between indentures of all colors and slaves, and that establishing clear definitions of exactly who was likely to become a slave proved difficult. At least some white colonists apparently did not distinguish blacks from other servants in their minds, and some early black indentured servants were released at the end of their indentures. A good example of this is Antonio Anthony Johnson, who arrived from Angola around 1624 as a slave, was sold to a merchant as an indentured servant, and was freed about a decade later, receiving land and a cow. In 1651, Johnson bought more land and his own indentured servants, including one black servant. Rather than viewing Africa as a source of unlimited labor, English colonists preferred European indentured servants well into the 1670s, even when they came from the ranks of criminals from English jails. But by the 1660s, the southern colonists had slowly altered their attitudes toward Africans. Increasingly, the Southerners viewed them as permanent servants, and in 1664, some Southern colonies declared slavery hereditary, as it had been in ancient Athens and still was throughout the Muslim world. Perhaps the greatest irony surrounding the introduction of black slaves was the timing, if the 1619 date is accurate. That year, the first elected legislative assembly convened at Jamestown. Members consisted of the governor and his council, and representatives, or burgesses, from each of the 11 plantations. The assembly gradually split into an upper house, the governor and council, and the lower house made up of the burgesses. This meant that the early forms of slavery and democracy in America were twin-born at Jamestown and, in their infancy, were rocked in the cradle of the Republic. Each of the colonists already had the rights of Englishmen, but the scarcity of labor forced the Virginia Company to grant new equal political rights within the colony to new migrants in the form of the privileges that land conferred. In that way, land and liberty became intertwined in the minds and attitudes of the Virginia founders. Virginia's founders may have believed in natural law concepts, but it was the cold reality of the endless labor shortages that put teeth in the colony's political rights, which strongly reflected the principle of common law, namely that government bubbled from the ground up, from the people to the leaders, not vice versa. Still, the early colonial government was relatively inefficient and inept in carrying out its primary mission of turning a profit. London Company stockholders failed to resupply the colony adequately, and had instead placed their hope in sending ever-growing numbers of settlers to Jamestown. Adding to the colony's miseries, the new arrivals soon encroached on Indian lands, eliciting hostile reaction. Powhatan's death in 1618 resulted in leadership of the Chesapeake tribes falling to his brother, Opechancano, who conceived a shrewd plan to destroy the English. Feigning friendship, the Indians encouraged a false sense of security among the careless colonists. Then, in 1622, Opechancano's followers launched simultaneous attacks on the settlements surrounding Jamestown, killing more than 300 settlers. The English retaliated by destroying Indian cornfields, a response that kept the Indians in check until 1644. Though blind, Opechancano remained the chief, and, still wanting vengeance, ordered a new wave of attacks that killed another 300 English in 2 days. Again, the settlers retaliated. They captured Opechancano, shot him, and forced the Indians from the region between the York and James Rivers. By that time, the Virginia Company had attracted considerable attention in England, none of it good. The king appointed a committee to look into the company's affairs and its perceived mismanagement, reflecting the fact that English investors, by then experiencing the fruits of commercial success at home, expected even more substantial returns from their successful operations abroad than they had received. Opechancano's raids seemed to reinforce the assessment that the London directors could not make prudent decisions about the colony's safety, and in 1624, the Court of King's Bench annulled the Virginia Company's charter, and the king assumed control of the colony as a royal province. Virginians became embroiled in English politics, particularly the struggle between the Cavaliers, supporters of the king, and the Puritans. In 1649, the Puritans executed Charles I, whose forces had surrendered 3 years earlier. When Charles was executed, Governor William Berkeley and the Assembly supported Charles II as the rightful ruler of England, earning for Virginia the nickname Old Dominion. Parliament, however, was in control in England and dispatched warships to bring the rebellious pro-Charles Virginians in line. After flirting with resistance, Berkeley and his Cavalier supporters ultimately yielded to the Puritan English parliamentarians. Then Parliament began to ignore the colony, allowing Virginia to assume a great deal of self-government. The new king, Charles II, the son of the executed Charles I, rewarded Berkeley and the Virginia Cavaliers for their loyalty. Berkeley was reappointed governor in 1660. But when he returned to his position, he was out of touch with the people and the assembly, which had grown more irascible, and was more intolerant than ever of religious minorities, including Quakers. At the same time, the colony's population had risen to 40,000, producing tensions with the governor that erupted in 1676 with the influx of settlers into territories reserved for the Indians. All that was needed for the underrepresented backcountry counties to rise against Berkeley and the Tidewater gentry was a leader. Bacon's Rebellion. Nathaniel Bacon, Jr., an eloquent and educated resident in Charles City County, had only lived in Virginia 14 months before he was named to the governor's council. A hero among commoners, Bacon nonetheless was an aristocrat who simmered over his lack of access to the governor's inner circle. His large farm in the west stood on the front line of frontier defense, and naturally Bacon favored an aggressive strategy against the Indians. But he was not alone. Many western Virginians, noting signs of unrest among the tribes, petitioned Berkeley for military protection. Bacon went further, offering to organize and lead his own expedition against the Indians. In June 1676, he demanded a commission against the heathen, saying, "God damn my blood, I came for a commission, and a commission I will have before I go." Governor Berkeley, convinced that the colonists had exaggerated the threat, refused to send troops and rejected Bacon's suggestion to form an independent unit. Meanwhile, small raids by both Indians and whites started to escalate into larger attacks. In 1676, Bacon, despite his lack of official approval, led a march to track hostiles. Instead, he encountered and killed friendly Indians, which threatened to drag the entire region into war. From a sense of betrayal, he then turned his 500 men on the government at Jamestown. Berkeley maneuvered to stave off a coup by Bacon when he appointed him general in charge of the Indian campaign. Satisfied, Bacon departed, whereupon Berkeley rescinded his support and attempted to raise an army loyal to himself. Bacon returned and, finding the ragtag militia, scattered Berkeley's hastily organized force, whereupon Bacon burned most of the buildings at Jamestown. No sooner had Bacon conquered Jamestown than he contracted a virus and died. Leaderless, Bacon's troops lacked the ability to resist Barclay and his forces, who, bolstered by the arrival of 1,100 British troops, regained control of the colony. Barclay promptly hanged 23 of the rebels and confiscated the property of others, actions that violated English property law and resulted in the governor being summoned back to England to explain his behavior. Reprimanded by King Charles, Barclay died before he could return to the colony. The Maryland Experiment. Although Virginia was a Protestant, Anglican colony, it must be stated again that the London Company did not have a religious agenda per se. A second Chesapeake colony was planted in 1634 when George Calvert received a grant from Charles I. Calvert, who enjoyed strong personal support from the king despite his conversion to Catholicism in 1625, already had mounted an unsuccessful mission to plant a colony in Newfoundland. After returning from the aborted Newfoundland venture, Calvert worked to obtain a charter for the northern part of Chesapeake Bay. Shortly after he died, the crown issued a charter in 1632 to Cecilius Calvert, George's son, naming George Calvert Lord Baltimore. The grant, named in honor of Charles I's wife, Queen Mary, gave Baltimore a vast expanse of land stretching from the Potomac River to the Atlantic Ocean. Calvert's grant gave him full proprietary control over the land, freeing him from many of the constraints that had limited the Virginia Company. As proprietor, Calvert acted rex in absentia, as the king in his absence, and as long as the proprietor acted in accordance with the laws of England, he spoke with the authority of the crown. Calvert never visited his colony, though, governing the province through his brother Leonard, who held the office of governor until 1647. Like Virginia, Maryland had an assembly, created in 1635, elected by all freeholders. In March 1634, approximately 300 passengers arrived at one of the eastern tributaries of the Potomac and established the village of St. Mary's. Located on a high cliff, St. Mary's had a good natural harbor, fresh water, and abundant vegetation. Father Andrew White, a priest who accompanied the settlers, observed of the region that "we cannot set down a foot without but tread on strawberries, raspberries, fallen mulberry vines, acorns, walnuts, and sassafras." The Maryland colony was planned better than Jamestown. It possessed a large proportion of laborers and fewer adventurers, country gentlemen, and gold seekers, and the settlers planted corn as soon as they had cleared the fields. Calvert, while not unaware of the monetary returns of a well-run colony, had another motive for creating a settlement in the New World. Catholics had faced severe persecution in England, and so Lord Baltimore expected that a large number of Catholics would welcome an opportunity to immigrate to Maryland when he enacted the Toleration Act of 1649, which permitted any Christian faith to be practiced in the colony. The act provided that "no person professing to believe in Jesus Christ shall from henceforth be in any ways troubled, molested, or discountenanced." Yet the English Catholics simply did not respond the way Calvert hoped. Thus, he had to welcome Protestant immigrants at the outset. Once the news of religious toleration spread, other religious immigrants came from Virginia, including a group of persecuted Puritans who established Annapolis. The Puritans proved a thorn in Baltimore's side, however, especially after the English Civil War put the Puritans in control there and they suspended the Toleration Act. After a brief period in which the Calvert family was deprived of all rights to govern, Lord Baltimore was supported, ironically, by the Puritan Lord Protector of England, Oliver Cromwell, and he was reinstated as governor in 1657. Religious conflict had not disappeared, however. An early wave of Jesuits worked to convert all of the colonies, antagonizing the Protestant majority. Thus, in many ways, the attempt to permit religious toleration resulted in conflict and, frequently, bloodshed. Nor did the immigration of Protestants into Maryland allay the nagging labor shortage. In 1640, Maryland established its own headright system, and still the demands for labor exceeded the supply. As in Virginia, Maryland planters solved the shortage through the use of indentured servants, and at the end of the 1600s, African slaves. Maryland enacted a law concerning Negroes and other slaves in 1664, which not only perpetuated the slave status of those already in bondage, but expanded slave status to whosoever freeborn woman shall intermarry with any slave. Maryland, therefore, with its large estates and black slaves, looked very much like Virginia. The Carolinas, Charlestown versus Celtic culture. Carolina, England's final 17th century mainland slave society, was established in 1663 when Charles II chartered the colony to 8 wealthy proprietors. Their land grant encompassed the territories known today as North and South Carolina. Although Charles's aim was to create a strategic buffer zone between Spanish Florida and Virginia, Carolina's proprietors instead sought agricultural riches. Charlestown, now Charleston, South Carolina, founded in 1670, was populated largely by English Barbados planters and their slaves. Soon they turned portions of the sweltering Carolina seacoast into productive rice plantations. Then, over the next century, indigo, a vegetable dye, became the planter's second most important cash crop, thanks to the subsidies available in the mercantilist system. From its outset, Carolina society was triracial. Blacks eventually constituted a majority of Carolinians, followed by a mix of Indians and Europeans. White Carolinians allied with Cherokee Indians to soundly defeat the rival Yamasees and Creeks and push them westward. Planters failed in their attempts to enslave defeated Indians, turning instead to black slaves to cultivate the hot, humid rice fields. A 1712 South Carolina statute made slavery essentially permanent. All Negroes, mulattoes, mestizos, or Indians, which at any time heretofore have been sold, and their children, are hereby made and declared slaves. Slave life in the Carolinas differed from Virginia because the rice plantation system initially depended almost exclusively on an all-male workforce. Life in the rice and indigo fields was incredibly harsh, resembling the conditions in Barbados. The crops demanded full-time attention at harvest, requiring exhausting physical labor in the Carolina sun. Yet colonial slave revolts like the 1739 Stono Revolt, which sent shockwaves through the planter community, were exceptions because language barriers among the slaves, close and brutal supervision, a climate of repression, and a culture of subservience all combined to keep rebellions infrequent. The perceived threat of slave rebellions nevertheless hung over the southern coastal areas of Carolina, where slaves often outnumbered whites 9-1. Many planters literally removed themselves from the site of possible revolts by fleeing to the port cities in the summer. Charlestown soon became an island where planter families spent the hot season free from the plantations, swamps, and malaria of the lowlands. By mid-18th century, Charlestown, with a population of 8,000 and major commercial connections, a lively social calendar of balls and cotillions, and even a paid symphony orchestra, was the leading city of the South. Northern Carolinians differed socially, politically, economically, and culturally from their neighbors to the South. In 1729, disputes forced a split into two separate colonies. The northern part of the colonies was geographically and economically more isolated, and it developed more slowly than South Carolina. In the northeastern lowlands and Piedmont, North Carolina's economy turned immediately to tobacco, while a new ethnic and cultural wave trekked south from Pennsylvania into North Carolina via Virginia's Great Valley. German and Celtic, Scots-Irish, farmers added flavor to the Anglo and African stew of Carolina society. Germans who arrived were pious Quaker and Moravian farmers in search of opportunities to farm and market wood, leather, and iron handicrafts, whereas Celts were the wild and woolly frontiersmen who had fast worn out their welcome in the civilized areas of Pennsylvania and Virginia. At that point, they moved on deeper and deeper into the forests of the Appalachian foothills and eventually the Trans-Appalachian West. Such a jambalaya of humankind immediately made for political strife as Eastern and Western North Carolinians squared off time and again in disputes that often boiled down to planter versus small farmer rivalries. Life of the Common Colonials. By the mid-1700s, it was clear across the American colonies that settlers had become increasingly less English. Travelers described Americans as coarse-looking country folk. Most colonials wore their hair long. Women and girls kept their hair covered with hats, hoods, and kerchiefs, while men and boys tied their hair into queues until wigs came into vogue in the port cities. Colonials made their own clothes from linen, flax, and wool. Every home had a spinning wheel and a loom, and women sewed and knitted constantly, since cotton cloth would not be readily available until the 19th century. Plentiful dyes like indigo, birch bark, and pokeberries made colorful shirts, pants, dresses, socks, and caps. Americans grew their own food and ate a great deal of corn, roasted, boiled, and cooked into cornmeal bread and pancakes, partly because wheat was so expensive. Hardy vegetables like squash and beans joined apples, jam, and syrup on the dinner table. And they were carnivores. As two historians of eating in America noted, game was not only the main meal of the colonists, it was often the main food. Men and boys hunted and fished. Rabbit, squirrel, bear, and deer, venison, were common entrees. Pig raising became important, but beef cows and milk were scarce until the 18th century and beyond. Virginia colonists ate so much pork that a century later, planter William Byrd quipped that Virginians were extremely hoggish in their temper and prone to grunt rather than speak. Given the poor quality of water, many colonials drank cider, beer, and corn whiskey, even the children. As cities sprang up, the lack of convenient watering holes led owners to water their cattle with the runoff of breweries, yielding a disgusting variant of milk known as swill milk, which propagated childhood illnesses. Even without swill milk, infant mortality was high, and any sickness usually meant suffering and, often, death. Colonials relied on folk medicine and Indian cures, including herbs, teas, honey, bark, and roots, supplemented with store-bought medicines. Doctors were few and far between. The American colonies had no medical school until the eve of the American Revolution, and veterinarians usually doubled as the town doctor, or vice versa. Into the vacuum of this absence of professional doctors stepped folk healers and midwives, bone crackers and bleeders. Going to a physician was usually the absolute last resort, since without anesthesia, any serious procedures would involve excruciating pain and extensive recovery. Women especially suffered during childbirth, and infants often had such high mortality rates that babies were not named until age 2. Instead, mothers and fathers referred to the child as the little visitor, or even it. Despite the reality of this difficult life, it is worth noting that by 1774, American colonists already had attained a standard of living that far surpassed that found in most of the civilized parts of the modern world. Far more than today, though, politics, and not the family, absorbed the attention of colonial men. Virtually anyone who either paid taxes or owned a minimum of property could vote for representation in both the upper and lower houses of the legislature, although in some colonies, Pennsylvania and New York, there was a higher property qualification required for the upper house than for the lower house. When it came to holding office, Most districts required a candidate to have at least 100 pounds in wealth or 100 acres, but several colonies had no requirements for holding office. Put another way, American colonials took politics seriously and believed that virtually everyone could participate. Two colonies stand out as examples of the trends in North American politics by the late 1700s, Virginia and Maryland. The growth and maturation of the societies in Virginia and Maryland established five important trends that would be repeated throughout much of America's colonial era. First, the sheer distance between the ruler and the governed, between the king and the colonies, made possible an extraordinary amount of independence among the Americans. In the case of Bacon's Rebellion, for example, the Virginia rebels acted on the principle that it is easier to ask forgiveness than to seek permission, and were confident that the crown would approve of their actions. Turmoil in England made communication even more difficult, and the instability in the English government, the temporary victory of Cromwell's Puritans, followed by the restoration of the Stuarts, merely made the colonial governments more self-reliant than ever. Second, while the colonists gained a measure of independence through distance, they also gained political confidence and status through the acquisition of land. For immigrants who came from a nation where the scarcity of land marked those who owned it as gentlemen and placed them among the political elites, the abundance of soil in Virginia and Maryland made them the equals of the owners of manorial estates in England. It steadily but subtly became every citizen's job to ensure the protection of property rights for all citizens, undercutting from the onset the widespread and entrenched class system that characterized Europe. Although not universal, Virginia had a powerful cousinocracy, nothing of the rigid French or English aristocracies constrained most Americans. To be sure, Virginia possessed a more pronounced social strata than Maryland, and certainly Massachusetts. Yet compared to Europe, there was more equality and less class distinction in America, even in the South. Third, the precedent of rebellion against a government that did not carry out the most basic mandates, protecting life, property, and a certain degree of religious freedom, at least from the Church of England, was established and supported by large numbers, if not the vast majority, of colonists. That view was tempered by the assumption that, again, such rebellion would not be necessary against an informed government. This explains, in part, Thomas Jefferson's inclusion in the Declaration of Independence, the references to the fact that the colonists had petitioned not only the king, but Parliament as well, to no avail. Both the possession of land and the presence of private property among almost all groups combined to create a concept of citizenship unseen in the world. The concept of jus soli, citizenship based on birth, was established as the basis for all citizenship in the English colonies, and soon began to apply to those even born elsewhere. Thus, anyone who arrived at the British American colonies soon came to think of himself as naturalized, and more important, anyone born within the confines of British America was immediately viewed by courts as natural-born subjects with the rights of Englishmen. It was another truly exceptional condition of the American founding. Fourth, a measure of religious toleration developed, although it was neither as broad as it is often claimed, nor did it originate in the charity of church leaders. Although Virginia Anglicans and Maryland Catholics built the skeleton of state-supported churches, labor problems forced each colony to abandon sectarian purity at an early stage to attract immigrants. Underlying presuppositions about religious freedom were narrowly focused on Christians, and in most colonies, usually Protestants. Had the colonists ever anticipated that Jews, Muslims, Buddhists, Hindus, or members of other non-Christian groups would constitute even a small minority in their region, even the most fiercely independent Protestants would have agreed to the establishment of a state church, as Massachusetts did from 1630 to 1830. America's vast size contributed to a tendency toward live and let live when it came to religion. Dissidents could always move to uninhabited areas. Certainly none of the denominations were open to evangelizing from their counterparts. Rather, the colonists embraced toleration, even if narrowly defined, because it affected a relatively cohesive group of Christian sects. Where differences that were potentially deeply divisive did exist, the separation caused by distance prevented one group from posing a threat to others. Throughout, a spirit of latitudinarianism dominated, wherein the state of the soul was viewed as more important than rigid church doctrine, and that human reason, aided by the Holy Spirit, could arrive at truth. Latitudinarianism thus de-emphasized church leadership and elevated lay participation. Finally, the experiences in Virginia and Maryland foreshadowed events elsewhere when it came to interaction with the Indians. The survival of a poorly armed, ineptly organized colony in Jamestown, surrounded by hostile natives, requires more of an explanation than white greed provides. Just as Europeans practiced balance of power politics, so too the Indians found that the presence of several potential enemies on many sides required that they treat the whites as friends when necessary to balance the power of other Indians. To the Doeg Indians, for example, the English were no more of a threat than the Susquehannock. Likewise, English settlers had as much to fear from the French as they did the natives. Characterizing the struggle as one of whites versus Indians does not reflect the balance of power politics that every group in the New World struggled to maintain among its enemies. New England's Pilgrims and Puritans. Whereas gold provided the motivation for the colonization of Virginia, the settlers who traveled to Plymouth came for much different reasons. The Puritans had witnessed a division in their ranks based on their approach to the Anglican Church. One group believed that not only should they remain in England, but that they also had a moral duty to purify the church from the inside. Others, however, had given up on Anglicanism. Labeled separatists, they favored removing themselves from England entirely, and they defied the orders of the king by leaving for European Protestant nations. Their disobedience to royal decrees and British law often earned the separatists persecution and even death. In 1608, a group of 125 separatists from Scrooby in Nottinghamshire slipped out of England for Holland. Among the most respected leaders of these pilgrims, as they later came to be known, was a 16-year-old boy named William Bradford. In Holland, they faced no religious persecution, but as foreigners, they found little work, and worse, Puritan children were exposed to the great licentiousness of Dutch youth. When few other English separatists joined them, the prospects for establishing a strong Puritan community in Holland seemed remote. After receiving assurances from the king that they could exercise their religious views freely, they opened negotiations with one of the proprietors of the Virginia Company, Sir Edwin Sandys, about obtaining a grant in Virginia. Sandys cared little for Puritanism, but he needed colonists in the New World. Certainly the Pilgrims already had displayed courage and resourcefulness. He therefore allowed them a tract near the mouth of the Hudson River, which was located on the northernmost boundary of the Virginia grant. To raise capital, the Pilgrims employed the joint stock company structure, which brought several non-separatists into the original band of settlers. Sailing on the Mayflower, 35 of the original Pilgrims and 65 other colonists left the English harbor of Plymouth in September 1620, bound for the Hudson River. Blown off course, the Pilgrims reached the New World in November, some 500 miles north of their intended location. They dropped anchor at Cape Cod Bay, at an area called Plymouth by John Smith. Arriving at the wrong place, the colonists remained aboard their vessel while they considered their situation. They were not in Virginia and had no charter to Plymouth. Any settlement could be perceived in England as defiance of the crown. Bradford and the 40 other adult men thus devised a document before they even went ashore to emphasize their allegiance to King James, to renounce any intention to create an independent republic, and to establish a civil government. It stated clearly that their purpose in sailing to Virginia was not for the purposes of rebellion, but for the glory of God and advancement of the Christian faith and honor of our king and country. And while the Mayflower Compact provided for laws and the administration of the colony, it constituted more than a mere civil code. It pledged each of them, solemnly and mutually in the presence of God and one another, to covenant and combine ourselves under a civil body politic, under just and equal laws for the furtherance of the glory of God. To the pilgrims, a just and equal society had to be grounded in religious faith. Developing along a parallel path to the concepts of government emerging in Virginia, the Mayflower Compact underscored the idea that government came from the governed, under God, and that the law treated all equally. But it also extended into civil affairs the concept of a church contract or covenant, reinforcing the close connection between the role of the church and the state. Finally, it started to lay a foundation for future action against both the King of England and, 80 years after that, slavery, by establishing basic principles in the contract. This constituted a critical development in an Anglo-European culture that increasingly emphasized written rights. As one of the first acts of their new democracy, the colonists selected John Carver as governor. Then, having taken care of administrative matters, in late December 1620, the pilgrims climbed out of their boats at Plymouth and settled at cleared land that may have been an Indian village years earlier. They had arrived too late in the year to plant, and like their countrymen farther south, the pilgrims suffered during their first winter, with half the colony perishing. The company had put all wealth of the individuals into a common pool. As Bradford later put it, "The experience we had with this common course and condition was that by taking away property and bringing community into a common wealth, it would make the colonists happy and flourishing, as if they were wiser than God." Bradford also described the reality that set in when young men that were most fit and able for labor and service did repine that they should spend their time and strength to work for other men's wives and children without any recompense was thought injustice. Recognizing the failure of communalism, the governor gave every family corn and a parcel of land, essentially instituting capitalism. The colonists saw no want that summer, and had a small harvest plus good stores of meat that fall. Squanto, whom Bradford called a special instrument sent from God, contrary to popular belief, did not have to teach the English how to hunt and fish. Rather, he served as middleman for bartering with the Indians, and by September 1621, crops were so abundant that the pilgrims held a feast to thank God, to which they invited the Indians. 2 years later, Bradford, who became governor when Carver died in April 1621, issued the first official Thanksgiving proclamation. The pilgrims, despite their fame in the traditional Thanksgiving celebration and their Mayflower Compact, never achieved the material success of the Virginia colonists or their Massachusetts successors at Massachusetts Bay. Indeed, the Plymouth colony's population stagnated. Since the separatists' religious views continued to meet a poor reception in England, no new infusions of people or ideas came from the old world. Having settled in a relatively poor region and lacking the excellent natural harbor of Boston, the pilgrims never developed the fishing or trading business of their counterparts. But the pilgrims rightly hold a place of high esteem in American history, largely because, unlike the Virginia settlers, the separatists braved the dangers and uncertainties of the voyage and settlement in the New World solely in the name of their Christian faith. Other Puritans, though certainly not all of them separatists, saw opportunities to establish their own settlements. They had particular incentives to do so after the ascension to the throne of England of Charles I in 1625. Puritans thought he was determined to restore Catholicism and eradicate religious dissidents. By that time, the Puritans had emerged as a powerful merchant group in English society, with their economic power translating into seats in Parliament. Charles reacted by dissolving Parliament in 1629. Meanwhile, a group of Dorchester businessmen had provided the perfect vehicle for the Puritans to undertake an experiment in the New World. In 1623, the Dorchester group established a small fishing post at Cape Ann near present-day Gloucester, Massachusetts. After the colony proved a dismal economic failure, the few settlers who had lived at Cape Ann moved inland to Salem, and a new patent granted in 1628 provided incentives for a new group of emigrants, including John Endicott, to settle in Salem. Ultimately, the New England Company, as it was called, obtained a royal charter in 1629. Stockholders in the company elected a general court, which chose the governor and his 18 assistants. Those prominent in founding the company saw the Salem and Cape Ann areas as opportunities for establishing Christian missions. The 1629 charter did not require the company's headquarters to be in London, as the Virginia companies had. Several Puritans, including John Winthrop, expressed their willingness to move to the trading colony if they could also move the colony's administration to Massachusetts. Stockholders unwilling to move to the New World resigned, and the Puritans gained control of the company, whereupon they chose John Winthrop as the governor. Called the Moses of the Great Puritan Exodus, Winthrop was Cambridge-educated and, because he was an attorney, relatively wealthy. He was also deeply committed to the Puritan variant of Christianity. Winthrop suffered from the Puritan dilemma, in that he knew that all things came from God and therefore had to be good. Therefore, all things were made for man to enjoy, except that man could not enjoy things too much, lest he risk putting material things above God. In short, Puritans had to be in the world, but not of it. Puritans, far from wearing drab clothes and avoiding pleasure, enjoyed all things. Winthrop himself loved pipe smoking and shooting. Moreover, Puritan ministers were the leaders in every field of intellectual advance in New England. Their moral codes in many ways were not far from modern standards. A substantial number of settlers joined Winthrop, with 11 ships leaving for Massachusetts that year. When the Puritans finally arrived, Winthrop delivered a sermon before the colonists disembarked. It resounded with many of the sentiments of the Plymouth Pilgrims. "We must consider that we shall be as a city upon a hill. The eyes of all people are upon us." Winthrop wanted the Puritans to see themselves as examples and, somewhat typical of his day, made dire predictions of their fate if they failed to live up to God's standard. More important, however, it was evident from the earliest times in America that a sense of exceptionalism existed.